For the first 2 days, we saw occasional white oryx and a few ostriches. After that, there was nothing. Hour after hour, day after day, we moved forward and nothing changed. The desert met the empty sky, always the same distance ahead of us. Time and space were one. Round us was a silence in which only the winds played, and a cleanness which was infinitely remote from the world of men. On my return, I went into Fasher, the provincial headquarters, for Christmas. At dinner, there was talk of the Italians having occupied Bir Nathrun. Recently, they had seized the small oasis of Oainat on the Sudan-Libyan frontier, which had been assumed to belong to the Sudan. This incident had led to protests and the exchange of notes. Now I heard that Dongola had reported to Khartoum that some Arabs had recently seen white men at Bir Nathrun, and that this was assumed to be further aggression by the Italians. Emergency measures had been taken, and aircraft had been moved to Wadi Halfa. I interrupted to say that I could not believe this, since I had just returned from Bir Nathrun, where I had only seen a few Arabs. A stunned silence followed, and then the CO of the Western Arab Corps said grimly, "I suppose you are the Italians." A little later, when I went through Khartoum on leave, it was pointed out to me firmly but sympathetically by the civil secretary that it was not customary to travel in someone else's district without the DC's consent, and certainly not a tour in another province without the governor's permission. At the end of 1937, I heard that I was to be transferred to Wad Madani, the headquarters of the Blue Nile province and the centre of the Gezira cotton scheme. I was appalled at the idea of spending 2 years or more in this African suburbia. On my way through Khartoum on leave, I persuaded the civil secretary to let me resign from the permanent political service and rejoin as a contract DC, on the understanding that I should not be asked to serve except in the wilds. This meant that I should no longer be eligible for a pension, but I doubted that I really wished to spend the rest of my active life in the Sudan. I had been happy in Darfur. I had found satisfaction in the stimulating harshness of this empty land, pleasure in the nomadic life which I had led. I had loved the hunting. It had been exciting to stalk Barbary sheep among the craters of Maidob, or Kudu in the Tagabo hills, or Adax or Oryx on the edge of the Libyan desert. It had been wildly exciting to charge with a mob of mounted tribesmen through thick bush after a galloping lion, to ride close behind it when it tired, while the Arabs waved their spears and shouted defiance, to circle round the patch of jungle in which it had come to bay, trying to make out its shape among the shadows, while the air quivered with its growls. I had grown fond of the people among whom I lived. I valued the qualities which they possessed, and was jealous for the preservation of their way of life. But I knew that I was not really suited to be a DC, as I had no faith in the changes which we were bringing about. I craved for the past, resented the present, and dreaded the future. I was posted to the Western Nuer district of the Upper Nile province. I went there on my return from leave, part of which I had spent in Morocco. The Nuer are Nilotics, kin to the Dinka and Shilluk, and they live in the swamps or sud which borders the White Nile to the south of Malakal. A pastoral people, who own great herds of cattle, they are a virile race of tall, stark, naked savages with handsome, arrogant faces and long hair dyed golden with cow's urine. The district had only been administered since 1925, and there had been some fierce fighting before they had submitted. But they were a people who had exerted a fascination over nearly all Englishmen who had encountered them. I lived on a paddle steamer with Wedderburn Maxwell, my district commissioner. We were left to ourselves. All that the governor asked was that he should get an occasional letter to say that we were all right. We kept a few files for our own convenience, but were not bothered with the mass of paper which accumulated on office desks in more conventional districts. we were happily out of touch with the rest of the Sudan, for there were no roads anywhere in the district. It was only possible to get there by steamer, and to travel in the district with porters. The country was full of game. I once saw 1,000 elephants in one vast herd along the river's banks. There were buffalo, and white rhinoceros, hippopotamus, giraffe, and many kinds of antelope. And there were leopards, and a great number of lions. I shot 70 lions during the 5 years I was in the Sudan. This was the Africa which I had read about as a boy, and which I had despaired of finding in the Sudan when I first saw Khartoum. The long line of naked porters winding across a plain dotted with grazing antelope, my trackers slipping through the dappled bush as we followed a herd of buffalo, the tense excitement as we closed in upon a lion at bay, the grunting cough as it charged, the reeking red shambles as we cut up a fallen elephant, a blood-caked youth grinning out from between the gaping ribs. White cattle egrets flying above the Nile against a background of papyrus, such as is depicted in the pharaoh's tombs. Lake No and the setting sun reflected redly in water that shone like polished steel. Hippopotamus grunting close by in a darkness that was alive with other sounds. Smoke rising over newer cattle camps. The leaping, twisting forms caught up in the excitement of a war dance. The rigid figures of young men undergoing the agony of initiation. Earlier in my life, this would have been all that I could have asked. But now I was troubled with memories of the desert. In 1938 I spent my leave in the Sahara and visited the Tibesti Mountains, which were unknown except to French officers who had travelled there on duty. I left Khartoum early in August, accompanied by a Zagawa lad, who had been my servant since I came to the Sudan, and an elderly Badayat, who knew the language of the Tibu, having lived in Tibesti. I had camels in Darfur to take us as far as Faya. After that we should need camels used to the mountains. We travelled light, the distances being great and the time short. Among the newer, I had lived in a tent, apart from my men, waited on by servants. I had been an Englishman travelling in Africa, but now I could revert happily to the desert ways which I had learned at Khartoum. For this was the real desert, where differences of race and colour, of wealth and social standing, are almost meaningless, where coverings of pretense are stripped away and basic truths emerge. It was a place where men live close together. Here to be alone was to feel at once the weight of fear, for the nakedness of this land was more terrifying than the darkest forest at dead of night. In the pitiless light of day, we were as insignificant as the beetles I watched labouring across the sand. Only in the kindly darkness could we borrow a few square feet of desert and find homeliness within the radius of the firelight, while overhead the familiar pattern of the stars screened the awful mystery of space. We did long marches, sometimes riding for 18 or 20 hours. At last we saw, faint like a cloud upon the desert's edge, the dim outline of Emi-Kusi, the crater summit of Tibesti. As we drew near, it dominated our world, sharp blue at dawn, and black against the setting sun. We climbed it with difficulty, and stood at last upon the crater's rim, 11,125 feet above sea level. Beneath us, in the crater's floor, was the vent, a great hole 1,000 feet deep. To the north were range upon range of jagged peaks, rising from shadowed gorges, an awful scene of utter desolation. Everywhere the rocks were slowly crumbling away, eroded by sun and wind and storm. It was a sombre land, black and red and brown and grey. We travelled across windswept uplands, over passes and through narrow gorges, under precipices, past towering peaks. From Bardai we visited the great crater of Doon, 2,500 feet in depth. We camped in the Modra Valley, beneath Tiroko. the most magnificent of all the Tibesti Mountains. When we returned to Darfur, we had ridden over 2,000 miles in 3 months. In the desert, I had found a freedom unattainable in civilization, a life unhampered by possessions, since everything that was not a necessity was an encumbrance. I had found, too, a comradeship, inherent in the circumstances and the belief that tranquillity was to be found there. I had learnt the satisfaction which comes from hardship, and the pleasure which springs from abstinence, the contentment of a full belly, the richness of meat, the taste of clean water, the ecstasy of surrender when the craving for sleep becomes a torment, the warmth of a fire in the chill of dawn. I went back to the Nuer, but I was lonely, sitting apart on a chair among a crowd of naked savages. I wanted more than they could give me, even while I enjoyed being with them. The Danakil journey had unsuited me for life in our civilization. It had confirmed and strengthened a craving for the wilds. The Nuer country would have met this need, but 3 years in Darfur and my recent journey to Tibesti had taught me to ask for more than this, for something which I was to find later in the deserts of Arabia. I had been posted back to Khartoum, but was still on leave when the war started, and, being without a district, I was allowed to join the Sudan Defence Force in April 1940. For me, the Abyssinian campaign had the quality of a crusade. 10 years earlier, I had watched the Emperor Haile Selassie being crowned in Addis Ababa. 6 years after this, I had seen him descend from the train at Victoria into exile. I am proud to have served in Abyssinia with Sanford's mission, which prepared the way for Haile Selassie's restoration, and to have fought in Wingate's Gideon force, which took him back from the Sudan through Gojam to Addis Ababa. From Abyssinia, I was sent to Syria, where I served in Jabal al-Druz, and later worked for a year among the tribes. The deserts in which I had travelled had been blanks in time as well as space. They had no intelligible history. The nomads who inhabited them had no known past. Some Bushman paintings, a few disputed references in Herodotus and Ptolemy, and tribal legends of the recent past were all that had come down to us. But in Syria, the patina of human history was thick along the edges of the desert. Damascus and Aleppo had been old before Rome was founded. Among the towns and villages, invasion after invasion had heaped ruin upon ruin, and each new conquest had imposed new conquerors upon the last. But the desert had always been inviolate. There I lived among tribes who claimed descent from Ishmael, and listened to old men who spoke of events which had occurred 1,000 years ago as if they had happened in their own youth. I went there with a belief in my own racial superiority, but in their tents I felt like an uncouth, inarticulate barbarian, an intruder from a shoddy and materialistic world. Yet from them I learnt how welcoming are the Arabs, and how generous is their hospitality. From Syria I went to Egypt, and then to the Western Desert, where I was with the Special Air Service Regiment. We travelled in jeeps and were divided into small parties, which hid in the desert and attacked the enemy's lines of communication. We carried food, water, and fuel with us. We required nothing from our surroundings. I was in the desert, but insulated from it by the jeep in which I travelled. It was simply a surface marked as good or bad going on the map. Even if we had stumbled on Zarzura, whose discovery had been the ambition of every Libyan explorer, I should have felt no interest. In the last year of the war I was again in Abyssinia, where I was political adviser at Desi in the north. The country required technicians, but had little use for political advisers. Frustrated and unhappy, I resigned. One evening in Addis Ababa, I met O.B. Lean, the desert locust specialist of the Food and Agriculture Organization, Rome. He said he was looking for someone to travel in the empty quarter of Arabia to collect information on locust movements. I said at once that I should love to do this, but that I was not an entomologist. Lean assured me that this was not nearly as important as knowledge of desert travel. I was offered the job and accepted it before we had finished dinner. All my past had been but a prelude to the 5 years that lay ahead of me. 2. Prelude in Darfur. The Wali of Darfur collects a party of Beit Katir at Salala to escort me to the sands of Ghanim. While waiting for their arrival, I travel in the Qara Mountains. The deserts of Arabia cover more than 1 million square miles, and the southern desert occupies nearly half of the total area. The southern desert stretches for 900 miles, from the frontier of the Yemen to the foothills of Oman, and for 500 miles from the southern coast of Arabia to the Persian Gulf and the borders of the Najd. The greater part of it is a wilderness of sand. It is a desert within a desert, so enormous and so desolate that even Arabs call it the Rub'ul Kali, or the Empty Quarter. In 1929, T. E. Lawrence wrote to Lord Trenchard, Marshal of the Royal Air Force, suggesting that either the R-100 or R-101 should be deviated on its trial flight to India to pass over the Empty Quarter. He wrote, "To go over the Empty Quarter will be an enormous advertisement for them. It will mark an era of exploration. Nothing but an airship can do it. And I want it to be one of ours which gets the plum." Nevertheless, in 1930, Bertram Thomas crossed this desert from south to north, and a few months later another Englishman, St. John Filby, crossed it again, this time from the north. Thomas and Filby had proved that the Empty Quarter could be crossed with camels. But when I went there 15 years later, they were the only Europeans who had travelled in it, and vast areas between the Yemen and Oman were still unexplored. When I was at Oxford, I had read Arabia Felix, in which Bertram Thomas described his journey. The month which I had already spent in the Danakil country had given me some appreciation and understanding of desert life, and Lawrence's Revolt in the Desert had awakened my interest in the Arabs. But while at Oxford, I longed only to return to Abyssinia. It was not until later that my thoughts turned more and more insistently to the Empty Quarter. Although I had travelled in the deserts of the Sudan and the Sahara, others had been before me, and the mystery was gone. The routes and wells, the dunes and mountains were marked on maps. The tribes were administered. The thrill that I had known when travelling in the Danakil country was missing. The Empty Quarter became for me the promised land. But the approaches to it were barred, until this chance meeting with Lean gave me my great opportunity. I was not really interested in locusts. I certainly would not have volunteered to go to Kenya or the Kalahari to look for them. But they provided me with the golden key to Arabia. Nowadays, one of the chief obstacles to travel in the few unexplored places of the world that remain is getting permission from the governments which claim them. It would have been difficult, perhaps even impossible, for me to have approached the Empty Quarter without the initial backing which I received from the Middle East Anti-Locust Unit. But, once I had been there and had made friends with the Bedou, I could travel where I wished. I had no need to worry about international boundaries that did not even exist on maps. I had already seen plenty of locusts in the Sudan, and during the year I was at Desi, I had watched swarms rolling across the horizon like clouds of smoke as they arrived on the Abyssinian uplands from their breeding places in Arabia. I had watched them going past, long-legged in wavering flight, as thick in the air as snowflakes in a storm. I had seen branches broken from trees by the weight of the settled swarms, and green fields stripped bare in a few hours. But although I knew how destructive they could be, I knew practically nothing about their habits. Therefore, before going to the empty quarter, I was sent to Saudi Arabia for 2 months to learn about locusts from Vasey Fitzgerald, who was running a campaign there. Few Europeans had previously been allowed to enter Saudi Arabia, and almost all of them had been confined to Jeddah, the port on the Red Sea, where the diplomats and the commercial community lived. Locust officers, however, were allowed to travel freely in nearly all parts of the country. During the war, a species of locust called the desert locust had threatened the Middle East with famine. It was known that one of the main breeding grounds was the Arabian Peninsula, and in 1943-4, the Middle East Anti-Locust Unit was given permission by King Abd al-Aziz ibn Saud to carry out a campaign against them in Saudi Arabia. Vasey Fitzgerald told me of the discoveries which had been made in recent years, and which were the reason for my journey into the empty quarter. Dr. Uvarov, who was head of the Anti-Locust Research Centre in London, had discovered that both the desert locust and a large solitary grasshopper belonged to the same species, although they differed in their habits, their colours, and even in the structure of their bodies, to such an extent that naturalists had named and described them as separate species. These solitary grasshoppers occasionally developed gregarious habits that were probably due to overcrowding. Their numbers would increase after a season of plentiful vegetation. And then, in the next dry season, when they were confined to a smaller area, they would swarm and migrate, ceasing to be solitary grasshoppers and becoming desert locusts. The small initial swarms increased very rapidly, for locusts breed several times a year, and each locust lays as many as 100 eggs at a time. The eggs hatch in about 3 weeks, and the young locusts, or hoppers, reach maturity in about 6 weeks. In Saudi Arabia, with Vasey Fitzgerald, I saw densely packed bands of hoppers extending over a front of several miles, and with a depth of 100 yards or more. And yet he told me that these were only small bands. I knew that with favourable wind, locusts can cover enormous distances. But I was amazed when he told me that swarms can breed in India during the monsoon, move in the autumn to southern Persia or Arabia, breed there again, and then pass on to the Sudan or East Africa. Some of these swarms cover 200 square miles or more. Eventually, disease attacks them and they vanish as quickly as they had appeared. Then, for a time, there are no more desert locusts in the world, only solitary grasshoppers. Dr. Uvarov believed that the outbreak centres were restricted to certain definite areas, and that if these could be located and controlled, it would be possible to prevent the solitary grasshoppers from ever swarming. The first thing to do was to locate all these outbreak centres. He thought that some of them might be in southern Arabia, especially at Mukshin, where Thomas had discovered that the great watercourses which ran inland from the coastal mountains of Darfar ended against the sands of the empty quarter. Darfar was known to get the monsoon, and it seemed probable that enough water flowed inland each year to produce permanent vegetation along the edge of the sands. If this was so, the area would almost certainly be an outbreak centre. I was to go there and find out. But so little was known about this part of southern Arabia that wherever I went I could collect no useful information. I arrived in Aden at the end of September 1945, visited the mountains along the Yemen frontier, and on the 15th of October flew to Salalah, the capital of Darfar, which lies about two-thirds of the way along the southern coast of Arabia. It was from there that I was to start my journey. While at Salalah, I stayed with the RAF in their camp outside the town. It was on a bare, stony plain, which was shut in by the Qara Mountains a few miles away, and had been set up during the war, when an air route from Aden to India was opened. This route was no longer used, but once a week an aeroplane came to Salalah from Aden. Darfar belonged to the Sultan of Muscat, and he had insisted, when he allowed the RAF to establish themselves there, that none of them should visit the town or travel anywhere outside the perimeter of the camp unless accompanied by one of his guards, and that none of them should speak to any of the local inhabitants. These restrictions also applied to me while I was staying in the camp. In the case of the RAF, they seemed to me to be reasonable, designed to prevent incidents between airmen who knew nothing of Arabs and tribesmen who were armed, quick-tempered, and suspicious of all strangers. But applied to me, who had come to travel with the people, they were extremely irksome. They meant that I had to make all my arrangements through the Wali, or governor. About 1877, Darfar had been occupied, after centuries of tribal anarchy, by a force belonging to the Sultan of Muscat. But in 1896 the tribes rebelled, surprised the fort that had been built at Salalah, and murdered the garrison. It was several months before the Sultan was able to reassert his authority, which, however, has since remained largely nominal, except on the plain surrounding the town. The morning after my arrival, I went into Salalah to call on the Wali. Salalah is a small town, little more than a village. It lies on the edge of the sea and has no harbour, the rollers from the Indian Ocean sweeping onto the white sands beneath the coconut palms that fringe the shore. When I arrived, fishermen were netting sardines, and piles of these fish were drying in the sun. The whole town reeked of their decay. The Sultan's palace, white and dazzling in the strong sunlight, was the most conspicuous building, and clustered around it was the small souk, or market. A number of flat-roofed mud-houses, and a labyrinth of mat shelters, fences, and narrow lanes. The market consisted of only a dozen shops, but it was the best shopping centre between Sur and the Hadramut, a distance of 800 miles. On my way to the palace I passed the mosque, near which were some old stone buildings and also an extensive graveyard. Scattered on the plain around the town were various ruins, all that remained of a legendary past, for Darfar is said to have been the Ophir of the Bible. The successive civilizations whose prosperity caused the Romans to name all this part of Arabia Arabia Felix had been farther to the west. The Minaeans had developed a civilization as early as 1000 BC, in the northeastern part of the Yemen. They were traders, with colonies as far north as Man near the Gulf of Aqaba, and they depended for their prosperity on frankincense from Darfar, which they marketed in Egypt and Syria. They were succeeded by the Sabaeans, who in turn were succeeded by the Himyarites. This southern Arabian civilization, which lasted for 1,500 years, came to an end in the middle of the 6th century AD. But while it lasted, this remote land acquired a reputation for fabulous wealth. For centuries, Egypt, Assyria, and the Seleucids schemed and fought to control the desert route along which the frankincense was carried northwards. And in 24 BC, the Emperor Augustus sent an army under Aelius Gallus, prefect of Egypt, to conquer the lands where this priceless gum originated. The army marched southwards for 900 miles, but lack of water eventually forced it to retire. This was the only time any European power had ever tried to invade Arabia. As I entered the town of Salalah, I passed a small caravan, two men with four camels tied head to tail, and when I questioned the guard who was with me, he said that these camels were carrying mukhur, or frankincense. Today, however, the trade is small and of little value, hardly more important in the market at Salalah than the buying and selling of goats and firewood. My attention was caught by the men who led the camels. They were small and wiry, about 5 feet 4 inches in height, and were dressed in a length of dark blue cloth, wound round their waists, with an end thrown over one shoulder. The indigo had run out from the cloth and smeared their chests and arms. They were bareheaded, and their hair was long and untidy. Both of them wore daggers and carried rifles. My guard said that they were Bedou from beyond the mountains, and that they belonged to the Beit Katir. In the marketplace were more of them, while others waited outside the palace gates. They reminded me of the tribesmen whom I had seen recently at Dala on the Yemen border, and seemed very different to the Arabs from the great Bedou tribes I had met in Syria and the Najd. The palace gates were guarded by armed men dressed in long Arab shirts and headcloths. Some of them were from Oman, and the rest were slaves. None were local tribesmen. One of them took me into the reception hall, where I met the Wali. He was a townsman from Oman, large and portly. He was dressed in a white shirt reaching to the ground, a brown cloak, embroidered with gold, and a Kashmiri shawl, which was loosely wrapped round his head. He wore a large, curved dagger at the middle of his stomach. I greeted him in Arabic, and before we started our discussion, I ate a few dates and drank 3 cups of bitter black coffee, handed to me by one of his retainers. The Wali told me that he had been instructed by the Sultan to collect a party of Bedou with camels to take me to Mukshin. He said that he had arranged for 45 Bedou to go with me, and that now he would send messengers into the desert to fetch them. I thanked him, but suggested that 45 were far more than I needed, and that 12 would be quite enough. I knew that the British consul in Muscat, when he got permission for me to do this journey, had agreed with the Sultan that the size of the party should be fixed by the Wali, and that I was to pay the equivalent of 10 shillings a day to each man who went with me. I realized that everyone here regarded my journey as a heaven-sent opportunity to enrich himself, and that they would all try to make my party as large as possible. The Wali now insisted that, as there was a serious risk of my meeting raiders, he could not take the responsibility of allowing me to go to Mukshin with fewer than 45 men, and that the Bedou themselves would not agree to go with a smaller party. I knew there had been raiding near Mukshin when Bertram Thomas went there in 1929, but as he was the only European who had ever crossed the Kwara Mountains, which I had seen that morning 6 or 8 miles beyond the camp, I was completely ignorant of what conditions were now like in the desert beyond. Eventually, after several meetings with the Wali, I agreed to take 30 Arabs. The Wali told me they would be from the Beit Katir tribe, and added that they would be ready to start in a fortnight. I arranged to spend this time travelling in the Kwara Mountains, which had been explored by Theodore and Mabel Bent in 1895, and by Bertram Thomas in 1929. The Wali said that he would send 4 of his retainers with me, 2 Omanis and 2 slaves, and that we should have to hire camels from the Kwara, who live in the mountains, changing them every time we crossed from one valley into the next, since each valley was owned by a different section of the tribe, and all of them were jealous of each other and much divided by feuds. He warned me, "Don't trust them. These mountain folk are not like the Bedou from the desert. They are treacherous and thievish, altogether without honour." It was obvious that although the Kwara lived only a few miles from Salalah, the Sultan of Muscat had little control over them. Arabs rule, but do not administer. Their government is intensely individualistic, and is successful or unsuccessful according to the degree of fear and respect which the ruler commands, and his skill in dealing with individual men. Founded on an individual life, their government is impermanent, and liable to end in chaos at any moment. To Arab tribesmen, this system is comprehensible and acceptable, and its success or failure should not be measured in terms of efficiency and justice as judged by Western standards. To these tribesmen, security can be bought too dearly by loss of individual freedom. 2 days later, we rode our camels across the stony plain of Jabib. We passed some cultivation and went on towards Jabal Kwara, which is about 2,000 feet high and is flanked on either side by much higher mountains, which close in on the sea. Some peculiarity in the shape of these mountains draws the monsoon clouds, so that the rain concentrates upon the southern slopes of Jabal Qara, which are, in consequence, covered with mist and rain throughout the summer, and were now dark with jungles in full leaf after the monsoon. All the way along the South Arabian coast, for 1,400 miles, from Perim to Sur, only these 20 miles get a regular rainfall. The mountains on either side are often beautiful, especially at dawn and sunset, when borrowed colours soften the austerity of rock and sand, but they are seldom touched with green. Usually the few camel thorns, which throw a thin mesh of shadow over the darkly patinated rock, rustle dryly in the breeze. But on Jabal Qara, the jungle trees are wreathed with jasmine and giant convolvulus, and roped together with lianas. Massive tamarinds grow in the valleys, and on the downs great fig trees rise above the wind-rippled grass like oaks in an English park. We camped in the mouth of a valley near a Qara village. To my unpracticed eye, these tribesmen were similar in appearance to the Beit Katir, whom I had seen in Salalah. But they spoke their own language, whereas the Beit Katir spoke Arabic. Three tribes, the Qara, Mara, and Harassis, as well as the remnants of others like the Shahara, speak different dialects of a common origin, and are known to the Arab-speaking tribes as the Al-Al-Hadara. Bertram Thomas had made some study of these dialects, sufficient to establish that they were closely related to the ancient Semitic languages of the Minaeans, Sabaeans, and Himyarites. He suggested that Hadara may perhaps be identified with Hadoram, who is given in Genesis as one of the sons of Joktan, a descendant of Shem, and that Hadramut, the present-day name of the country immediately to the west of the Mara country, could be connected with Hazara Maveth, the brother of Hadoram. As we climbed the mountainside, I noticed paradise flycatchers, rufous and black, with long white streamers in their tails, and brilliant butterflies. They were in keeping with the jungles which surrounded us and as unexpected in Arabia. Then we came out onto the downs and camped near the top of the mountain. I walked to the watershed, anxious to see what lay beyond, and found myself standing between two worlds. To the south were green meadows where cattle grazed, thickets and spreading trees, whereas a stone's throw to the north was empty desert, sand, rocks, and a few wisps of withered grass. The transition was as abrupt as it is between the irrigated fields and the desert in the Nile Valley. Here, the dividing line followed the crest of the mountains. The Qara were camped in family groups on the downs. They owned small, humpless cattle, a few camels, and flocks of goats, but no sheep, horses, or dogs. Most of the families owned 20 to 30 cows. Thomas mentioned in his book that when a man died, his family sacrificed half his cows. He thought that this custom was peculiar to them, but apparently the Wahiba, a Bedou tribe in Oman, do the same. They also had another strange practice, which hitherto I had seen only among the Nuer in the southern Sudan. Before a man milked a cow, women were forbidden even to touch the udders, he would sometimes put his lips to the cow's vagina and blow into it, to induce the cow to lower her milk. These Qara told me that they would remain here until January and then move down to the foot of the mountain and collect in large cattle camps, one of which we had passed on the way, small grass shelters crowded together in the mouth of the valley. When the monsoon started, they would move back into the valleys and shelter their animals in caves in the limestone cliffs, or in low, dark byres made of stones and roofed with matted grass. I stayed there for 10 days. Then I heard rumours that the Beit Katir, who were to go with me, were in Salalah, and I decided to go back. Some Qara came with us. They carried butter, firewood, and a pot of wild honey, which they would sell in the market. They said they would buy dried sardines, which they feed to their animals later in the season when the grazing gets scarce. On my return, the Wali invited me to meet some of the Beit Katir, who were to go with me. There were eight of them, sitting with him when I arrived. Six wore headcloths and Arab shirts reaching halfway down their calves. Two were bareheaded and dressed only in loincloths. All wore daggers and cartridge belts. They had left their rifles outside the audience hall. While we drank coffee and ate dates, I wondered how I should get on with these people. An old man with a fringe of white beard and twinkling eyes, Salim Tamtame, was their head sheikh. The Wali said he was 80 but still vigorous, having just married another wife. And the old man exclaimed, "Hey, by God, I can still ride and shoot." I noticed especially a man called Sultan, who looked more like a Red Indian than an Arab. The others deferred to him rather than to Tamtame, and I remembered that the Quara had said, "Sultan has arrived in Salalah with the Beit Katir." It was obvious that he was their leader. He had a striking face, austere, lined and hairless, except for a few hairs growing in a curl on his chin. The Wali pointed to another of them and said, "Musalim will shoot meat for you. He is famous as a hunter." The man of whom he spoke was dressed in a clean white shirt and an embroidered headcloth. He was a small man, like all the others, but he was more solidly built and slightly bow-legged. He looked more of a townsman than a Bedou. I arranged with them that they should fetch me next morning from the RAF camp. They arrived after breakfast, accompanied by a large crowd from Salalah. They were a wild-looking lot, most of them wearing only loincloths, and all of them armed with rifles and daggers. I showed old Tamtane and Sultan the food I had provided for the journey. Rice, flour, dates, sugar, tea, coffee, and liquid butter. With the help of the RAF storeman, I had done it up in sacks in what seemed to me suitable-sized loads. But Sultan said at once that they were too heavy. They undid them and started to repack, pouring the rice, flour, and sugar into dirty-looking goatskin bags. They argued endlessly among themselves, shouting in harsh voices. The camels were led up and couched, but they struggled, roaring to their feet, and were couched again. An unkempt savage, with inflamed eyes and a tangled mob of hair, refused to allow a camel to be loaded, and started to lead it away. Someone else seized the camel's halter, and I thought they were going to fight. Everyone else gathered round and shouted. I could understand little of what they said. Eventually the camel was led back and loaded. When they were nearly ready, I went into the hut where I had been staying and put on my Arab clothes. To have worn European clothes would have alienated these Beit Katir at once, for although a few of them had travelled with Bertram Thomas, most of them had not even spoken to an Englishman before. I wore a loincloth, a long shirt, and a headcloth with the ends twisted round my head in their fashion. None of these Beit Katir wore the black woollen head-rope, which is a conspicuous feature of Arab dress in the north. As this was the first time I had worn Arab dress, I felt extremely self-conscious. My shirt was new, white, and rather stiff, very noticeable among the Bedou's dingy clothes. They were all small men, and as I am 6'2", I felt as conspicuous as a lighthouse, and as different from them as one of the RAF. On previous journeys, I had commanded respect as an Englishman, and in the Sudan I had the prestige of being a government official. When I had travelled in the desert there, I had tried to break through the barrier that lay between me and my companions, but I had always felt rather condescending. Now, for the first time, I was travelling without a servant, quite alone among a crowd of Arabs whom I had never seen before. I should be with them for 3 or 4 months, even for 6 if I undertook the second journey to the Hadhramaut, which I was already planning. At first glance they seemed to be little better than savages, as primitive as the Danakil, but I was soon disconcerted to discover that while they were prepared to tolerate me as a source of very welcome revenue, they never doubted my inferiority. They were Muslims and Bedou, and I was neither. They had never heard of the English, for all Europeans were known to them simply as Christians, or, more probably, infidels, and nationality had no meaning for them. They had heard vaguely of the war as a war between the Christians, and of the Aden government as a Christian government. Their world was the desert, and they had little, if any, interest in events that happened outside it. They identified me with the Christians from Aden, but had no idea of any power greater than that of Ibn Saud. One day they spoke of a sheikh in the Hadramaut, who had recently defied the government and against whom the Aden levies had carried out some rather inconclusive operations. I realized that they thought that this force was all that my tribe could muster. They judged power by the number and effectiveness of fighting men, not by machines which they could not understand. I shall always remember the first camp at the foot of the Qara Mountains. We had stopped in a shallow watercourse which ran out into the plain, and we had dumped our kit wherever there was room for it among thorn bushes and boulders. The others were soon busy, greasing waterskins, twisting rope, mending saddles, and looking to their camels. I sat near them, very conscious of their scrutiny. I longed to go over and join them in their tasks, but I was kept awkwardly apart by my reserve. For the first and last time, I felt lonely in Arabia. Eventually, old Tamtam hobbled over and invited me to drink coffee with them, and Sultan fetched my blankets and saddlebags and put them down beside the fire. Later, Musalim cooked rice, and six of us fed together. I asked them about the Rub al-Kali, or the empty quarter, the goal of my ambitions. No one had heard of it. What is he talking about? What does he want? God alone knows. I cannot understand his talk. At last Sultan exclaimed, "Oh, he means the sands." And I realized that this was their name for the great desert of southern Arabia. I have heard townsmen and villagers in the Najd and the Hejaz refer to it as the Rub al-Kali, but never Bedu, who lived upon its borders. I found it difficult to understand their talk. In the Sudan, I had learned Arabic among tribes who spoke it as their second language. I had really only begun to speak it when I was in Syria during the war. But there was a great difference between Syrian Arabic and the dialect of the Beit Katir, whose pronunciation and intonation were entirely different from anything I had heard before, and many of whose words were archaic. The Beit Katir were equally puzzled by my speech, but this did not stop them from asking questions about the Christians. Did they know God? Did they fast and pray? Were they circumcised? Did they marry like Muslims or just take a woman when they wanted one? How much bride price did they pay? Did they own camels? Were they tribesmen? How did they bury their dead? It was always questions such as these that they asked me. None of them had any interest in the cars and aeroplanes which they had seen in the RAF camp. The rifles with which they fought were all that they had accepted from the outside world, the only modern invention which interested them. They spoke of Bertram Thomas, who had travelled with them. Bedu notice everything and forget nothing. Garrulous by nature, they reminisce endlessly, whiling away with the chatter the long marching hours and talking late into the night round their campfires. Their life is at all times desperately hard, and they are merciless critics of those who fall short in patience, good humour, generosity, loyalty, or courage. They make no allowance for the stranger. Whoever lives with the Bedou must accept Bedou conventions and conform to Bedou standards. Only those who have journeyed with them can appreciate the strain of such a life. These tribesmen are accustomed since birth to the physical hardships of the desert, to drink the scanty, bitter water of the sands, to eat gritty, unleavened bread, to endure the maddening irritation of driven sand, intense cold, heat and blinding glare in a land without shade or cloud. But more wearing still is the nervous tension. I was to learn how hard it is to live crowded together with people of another faith, speech, and culture, in the solitude of the desert, how easy to be provoked to senseless wrath by the importunities and improvidence. Bertram Thomas had reason to be impatient. He lost precious months of the cold weather waiting in Darfar for his guide, Bin Kalut, and the other Rashid to arrive. The previous year he had reached Mukshin, and there, upon the threshold of the sands, had been thwarted by his Beit Katir companions. He was far from being a Bedou by nature, and yet I never heard these Bedou speak a disparaging word about him. I have known them criticize him for tiring their camels with the heavy foreign saddle on which he rode, or comment on his preference for sleeping apart from his companions. But these were idiosyncrasies which they accepted, even if they never understood them. Things which they now recalled with a smile. He was the first European to come among them, and he won their respect by his good nature, generosity, and determination. They remembered him as a good travelling companion. When I went among these exclusive tribesmen 16 years after he had left them, I was welcomed because I belonged to the same tribe as Thomas. I had only met him twice, in Cairo during the war, and then only for a few minutes. I should have liked to meet him again before he died, to tell him how much I owed to him. 3. The Sands of Ghanim. After travelling to the sands of Ghanim and Mukshin, we return to Salalah. There I meet the Rashid for the first time and travel with them to the Hadramut. This first journey on the fringes of the empty quarter was only important to me as my probation for the far longer and more difficult journeys that were to follow. During the next 5 months, I learnt to adapt myself to Bedou ways and to the rhythm of their life. My companions were always awake and moving about as soon as it was light. I think the cold prevented them from sleeping, except in snatches, for they had little to cover them other than the clothes they wore, and during these winter nights there was often a ground frost. Still half asleep, I would hear them rousing the camels from their couching places. The camels roared and gurgled as they were moved, and the Arabs shouted to each other in their harsh, far-carrying voices. The camels would shuffle past, their forelegs hobbled to prevent them straying, their breath white on the cold air. A boy would drive them towards the nearest bushes. Then someone would give the call to prayer. God is most great. I testify that there is no God but God. I testify that Muhammad is the prophet of God. Come to prayer. Come to salvation. Prayer is better than sleep. God is most great. There is no God but God. Each line, except the last, was repeated twice. The lingering music of the words, strangely compelling, even to me who did not share their faith, hung over the silent camp. I would watch old Tamtain, who slept near me, washing before he prayed. Every act had to be performed exactly and in order. He washed his face, hands and feet, sucked water into his nostrils, put wet fingers into his ears, and passed wet hands over the top of his head. The Beit Katir prayed singly, each man in his own place and in his own time, whereas the Rashid, with whom I later travelled, prayed together and in line. Tamtaim swept the ground before him, placed his rifle in front of him, and then prayed facing towards Mecca. He stood upright, bent forward, his hands on his knees, knelt, and then bowed down till his forehead touched the ground. Several times he performed these ritual movements, slowly and impressively, while he recited the formal prayer. Sometimes, after he had finished his prayers, he intoned long passages from the Quran, and the very sound of the words had the quality of great poetry. Many of these Bedou knew only the opening verse of the Quran. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, the Compassionate, the Merciful, King on the Day of Reckoning. Thee only do we worship, and to Thee do we cry for help. guide us on the straight path, the path of those to whom thou hast been gracious, with whom thou art not angry, and who go not astray. This verse they repeated several times as they prayed. Muslims should pray at dawn, at noon, in the afternoon, at sunset, and after dark. The Beit Katir prayed at dawn and sunset, but most of them neglected the other prayers. A little later I would hear bell-like notes as someone pounded coffee in a brass mortar, varying his stroke to produce the semblance of a tune. I would get up. In the desert we slept in our clothes, so that all I had to do was to adjust my headcloth, pour a little water over my hands, splash it over my face, and then go over to the fire and greet the Arabs who were sitting round it. "Salam alaikum," peace be on you. And they would stand up and answer, "Alaikum as-salam," on you be peace. Bedu always rise to return a salutation. If we were not in a hurry, we would break bread for breakfast. Otherwise we would eat scraps set aside from our meal the night before. We would drink tea, sweet and black, and then coffee, which was bitter, black, and very strong. The coffee drinking was a formal business, not to be hurried. The server stood as he poured a few drops into a small china cup, little bigger than an egg cup, which he handed to each of us in turn, bowing as he did so. Each person was served until he shook the cup slightly as he handed it back, signifying that he had had enough. It was not customary to take more than three cups. The camels were now rounded up and brought in to be saddled and loaded. Sultan went over to fetch Umbrosha, the camel I was riding. She was a magnificent animal, a famous thoroughbred from Oman. The other camels seemed to me to be very small, adjudged by Sudanese standards, and all of them were in poor condition. Sultan had told me that there had been no proper rain in the desert for the last 3 years, and that their animals were weak from hunger. The camels which these Bedu rode were females. In the Sudan, I had always ridden on bulls, since both there and in those parts of the Sahara where I had travelled, the females are kept for milk and never ridden. Throughout Arabia, however, females are ridden from choice. The tribes which carry goods for hire use the bulls as pack animals. But the Beit Katir slaughter nearly all the male calves at birth. They live largely on camel's milk, and have no desire to squander food on animals which can make no return, since there is no carrying trade in this desert. Bull camels, to act as sires, are consequently very rare. Later, when I travelled to the Hadhramut, I was accompanied by a man who rode one. We were continuously pursued by tribesmen with females to be served. We had a long journey in front of us, and this constant exercise was visibly exhausting my companion's mount, but he could not protest. Custom demanded that this camel should be allowed to serve as many females as were produced. No one even asked the owner's permission. They just brought up a camel, had it served, and took it away. Loading the camels was a noisy business, for most of them roared and snarled whenever they were approached, and especially when the loads were placed on their backs. I asked Sultan how they managed on raids when silence was important, and he told me that they then tied the camels' mouths. The noise which our camels were making would have been heard 2 miles away, or even farther in the desert stillness. Sultan had brought Umbrosha over to the place where I had slept, leading her by her head rope. He now jerked downwards on it, saying, "Kr, kr," and she dropped to her knees. She then swayed backwards, and after settling her hind legs under her, sank down onto her hocks. She then shuffled her knees forward until she was comfortably settled on the ground, her chest resting on the horny pad between her forelegs. Sultan tied one of her forelegs with the end of the head rope to prevent her rising while he was loading her. Umbrosha was properly trained, and this was not necessary, but an Arab near us was having a lot of trouble with a young animal. She struggled back to her feet after he had couched her, and even after he had tied her knees she half rose and then pivoted round among the loads which he had been trying to put on her back. She snarled and gurgled, spewing half-chewed green cud over his shirt. "May raiders get you!" he shouted at her in exasperation. She looked as if she would bite his head off at any moment. But female camels are really very gentle and do not bite. Male camels will bite, especially when they are rutting, and they inflict appalling injuries. I had treated a man in the Sudan